from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. It's official, PG&E filed for bankruptcy in San Francisco this morning. The company is facing mounting debts and liability for the state's wildfires. And PG&E says it expects no disruptions in service for its 16 million customers. State Senator and longtime PG&E critic Jerry Hill said today the move may be in PG&E's best interests, but not those of ratepayers and fire victims.
This is the easy way to go for them. This is the way that they can move forward and put everyone at risk.
Coming up on Forum, we'll discuss PG&E's bankruptcy filing and what happens next. That's next after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The power and gas will stay on. That's what PG&E posted in a statement on its website early this morning after it filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection. The utility is facing tens of billions in potential liability stemming from the deadly Northern California wildfires in 2017 and 2018. Experts say that the bankruptcy process could take many years and could eventually lead to higher electricity rates and lower payouts for wildfire victims. It could also take a toll on the state's renewable energy goals. PG&E's filing comes despite the finding last week that the company's equipment was not responsible for the 2017 Tubbs fire that killed 22 people in Sonoma County. And critics say there's no need for the utility to enter bankruptcy, pointing out that PG&E is a solvent company with assets worth over $71 billion. In this hour, we're going to take a look at what's going on. We're going to talk about PG&E's bankruptcy filing and what happens next. And joining us here in studio are a couple of our fine reporters, KQED reporters who have been following and right on top of this story, data reporter Lisa Pickoff-White. Good morning, Lisa.
Good morning.
And Marisa Lagos, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk. Morning, Marisa.
Hey, Michael. Good to be here.
Good to have you here. We also want to welcome by phone at about 9:15 or so, Mindy Spad, who is Communication Chief Return, and we're going to have other guests in the course of this hour. But first, let's get the big picture from our two reporters. And let me begin, Marisa, with you. It would appear at this point that at least the employees for about 30 days are going to get wages and benefits, and it would also appear that service will go on for the 16 million who need the service. But there's a lot of devil in the details in this reorganization plan, and where are we at this point?
Yeah, so I mean, this is sort of the opening salvo from PG&E, and as you noted, we've been expecting this for about 2 weeks since they filed their intent to do this filing. I think what's interesting about this, I mean, yes, I think first, the lights are going to stay on. The gas will keep flowing. I think employees should know that they will get paid. And I think beyond that 30 days, I don't think there's any question about that. The argument PG&E is basically making in this financing is that even though they're actually solvent, I mean, they're listing $20 billion more in assets than debt. They're saying, you know, we have such a big operation that we rely on borrowing to keep paying our bills on a monthly basis, and we can't get that financing now. What they're basically saying is that over the last year and a half, you know, their stock price plummeted. Eventually, they were downgraded to junk bond status, which makes it essentially prohibitively expensive to borrow cash. And they think that this is really the only way forward. I think there's a lot of people who would disagree with that, including some of their own shareholders. But at this point, they are asking the court to approve $5.5 billion of this debtor in possession financing. This is basically financing that big banks will offer because they are going to be first in line to get paid back under these bankruptcy proceedings. And so they're asking the court to do that. And then we're also seeing sort of the filings begin from the debtors and shareholders and other people involved who want to make sure that they're made whole or at least as whole as possible. And we do know that some of that is already coming in some sort of debates over some of the renewable energy contracts.
I was just going to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Sketch that out for us if you
could. Yeah, so before this filing actually even took place, as we knew it was coming, a handful of their renewable energy contractors asked federal authorities to basically step in and sort of assert their authority here. They want to make sure that they still get made whole from these contracts that they've signed with PG&E. What PG&E is telling the court is that essentially they signed really expensive renewable contracts originally because they needed to help build out the infrastructure, and that kind of the entire market has benefited from what they see as now too expensive contracts. And so they're basically asking the court to tell federal regulators to butt out. It's not clear what the court will do or what FERC, the federal regulators, how they'll respond. But I think that this is going to be, you know, there's wildfire victims, there's ratepayer questions, there's, you know, debtor questions. But I think that this renewable energy question and the state's climate change goals are going to be a really big question mark for everyone in California, because this is the state's largest utility. They have been a leader in helping the state, reach all the goals that we've set. And those goals are going to continue out into 2030 and 2050, well beyond this bankruptcy proceeding.
What does this do to the ruling that they have to actually pay the same rates to renewable energy sources?
Well, you know, I think that's what is going to be debated by this bankruptcy judge. And we expect that we'll see what's called a first day hearing, maybe not today, but in the next few days. I think that that's going to be a point of contention. And that also could be something not just related to renewables, but sort of broader regulatory questions over how much ratepayers should be expected to pay, general reorganization of these operations that I think state regulators are going to want to be at least partly at the table as well. And again, like, you know, they've been through bankruptcy before 18 years ago. It was a slightly different situation there. I think that one of the big question marks here is how is the fact that a lot of the liabilities they're citing haven't actually come down yet going to impact how the bankruptcy judge sort of views this and what they're doing? Because, you know, we know that, for example, they were found last week to not have been responsible for causing the Tubbs fire in Sonoma County. They say they never thought that they were going to be held responsible for that and that they thought this was going to be necessary anyway. But the Camp Fire in Butte County, we don't have an official cause. And I think one thing bankruptcy lawyers I talked to said that was unusual about this case is that it seems like the utility is also projecting potential future liabilities in the sense that they're worried, what if a fire breaks out this year or next year? Are they going to have the capital to cover those costs as well?
And there are some new developments. Lisa, I'd like to hear from you what we know actually in the recent hours, for that matter. Yeah.
Yeah. So in the last few hours, as Marisa mentioned, lots of people joined this bankruptcy filing. So it's not just PG&E who's going to appear in bankruptcy court. And so we've already seen other groups, including a renewable company, NextEra, a hedge fund, also the California Community Choice Association, and an environmental consulting firm who have joined the case just in the last few hours. We've also seen the stock, actually, of PG&E go slightly up just this morning as I was walking in. And I think we're going to continue to see a lot. We've also seen, as Marisa mentioned, a motion already with regulators. The CPUC, the California Public Utilities Commission, is going to be a really big part of all of this, because at the end of the day, PG&E is going to work with a bankruptcy judge to determine how they're going to pay back all of this debt and who is going to pay it back for that debt. But the bankruptcy judge can't just issue a proclamation about who's paying for that. The Public Utilities Commission is actually the one who has to approve where all that money is going and whether ratepayers, people like you or me who pay PG&E for our electricity and our gas, how that's going to affect us. And
excuse me, didn't the CPUC actually set up a $6 billion debtor thing on Monday?
Yeah, so they called an emergency meeting yesterday that I covered. And what that basically did is say, hey, bankruptcy judge, we're going to work with you. We're not going to stand in the way of this DIP financing going forward. It was interesting. There was an addition kind of at the last moment to President Michael Picker's statement on that, saying that though the CPUC, of course, reserves the right in the future to determine how that money is apportioned out to ratepayers.
And we also have Catherine Sandoval with us, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University. She's also a former CPUC commissioner. Welcome to the program. Good to have you here in studio.
Good morning. Thank you.
So your thoughts, your reflections on all this.
So a couple of things stand out from the bankruptcy filing. Number one is that in looking at the numbers that PG&E filed, PG&E is not insolvent. They emphasize that they have over $71 billion in assets and project $51 billion in debts. Well, that makes them a company that is not insolvent. So the second thing that really stood out to me was that in their filing, they said, we've decided to file for bankruptcy because we believe that there may be as much as $30 billion in liabilities related to wildfires. Well, I was very surprised that they didn't update that based upon CAL FIRE's finding last week that, in fact, the Tubbs fire was caused by a homeowner's private electrical system and not by PG&E.
So it's premature for them to file?
they didn't really establish what was the numerical foundation for saying that they are bankrupt. And particularly with regard to the Tubbs fire, there are estimates that taking that off the table as a PG&E liability, although there are lawyers who will still argue that they are at fault, that that reduced their potential liabilities by as much as $17 billion. So just doing the math, and that means out of $30 billion projected earlier this month, there should only be $13 billion left. But there was no accounting for how do they actually come up with this number that is supposedly the basis for filing for bankruptcy.
Either of you reporters want to weigh in here? I mean, this, you know, has to be unentangled at this point.
Yeah, and I think we will see hopefully more information coming out in the coming days. I mean, PG&E, I think, has sort of stuck to the same line. They didn't mention $30 billion, interestingly, in the statement they put out this morning. They kind of have made that a little more vague. And, I think it's important to note that, like, we're calling it potentially tens of billions of dollars because there's a lot of questions about these numbers, how much they'll actually be held responsible for. You know, what lawyers for Tubbs victims say is they're going to keep pursuing PG&E in court. They think that even if PG&E didn't start the fire, that they could still be held responsible because they didn't proactively turn off the power when they knew that conditions were right for this. So I guess in PG&E's defense, you know, maybe that Tubbs finding won't completely change the dynamic in that realm. But I think we are watching really closely to see what else they do file, how they sort of continue to flesh out this argument. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting that they have pledged not just to keep the lights on and to keep paying their employees, but, you know, to continue, they say, with safety programs to prevent future fires, to continue with programs that help customers get to those clean energy goals we talked about earlier, to help low-income customers. So I think they're really trying to frame this that, you know, this is going to let us continue operating with business as usual. But of course, you know, for all those people who own billions of dollars of bond debt or share, you know, there's over 50,000 shareholders. You know, there's a lot of questions here.
There are a lot of debt. Well, let me just go to a kind of a basic question with you, Lisa. I mean, debts are frozen and the CPUC, I think we're hearing this, has really approved up to $10 billion in loans, right?
They approved yesterday up to $6.1 billion in this what we're calling DIP financing, which is really financing that takes them through this initial bankruptcy.
This is what they call debtor in possession financing.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And so the CPUC approved $6.1 billion in that. PG&E filed this morning. They're hoping to have a hearing today or tomorrow to get a bankruptcy judge who still has to approve it, $1.5 billion of that. And then they're saying that in the next 30 to 45 days, they're going to ask for the rest of the $4 billion, I'm sorry, we're big bees here, of that financing. But I think, you know, we're going to keep circling around this question of liability because it really is the elephant in the room. The Department of Insurance upped the claims that they think the campfire will be at $11.4 billion yesterday. But at the end of the day, this is all going to be a massive multi-year long negotiation. It's going to be a negotiation between PG&E, between the Public Utilities Commission, between the bankruptcy judge, and also between insurance companies who are also very deep pocketed and are going to throw a lot at this because they really want to get their money back. And then, of course, the fire victims as well.
And there's also a role in this. We're talking about some of the opposition. Let's talk about Blue Mountain Capital for a moment, the asset manager.
Yeah, so the shareholder group has protested this bankruptcy since PG&E initially said that they're going to go through with it. And they are hoping to vote off the board of directors in a meeting in February.
I'm going to give the number now, and we do want to hear from you, and we want to hear any questions you might have, but also your response to this filing. And it is in many ways momentous. Of course, it brings us back in many ways to 2001, but there are many different circumstances, and certainly like to know your thoughts and any questions you might have. You can join us at our toll-free number right now at 866-733-6786. The number again to call, toll-free, 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. I want to bring Mindy Spad into this. She's communications chief for TURN. And Mindy, good to have you back with us in Forum. Good
Great
morning.
Great to be with you, Michael.
Talk about the timing on this, Mindy, can you? Because from your perspective, there is reason to arouse suspicion, perhaps?
Absolutely. Despite having been found not liable for the Tubbs fire, despite having not yet been found liable for the campfire, And despite having received new financing through the PUC, PG&E was hell-bent on declaring bankruptcy today. And we suspect that's because they are facing a criminal court judge tomorrow in a probation hearing.
And you're also concerned, and I was alluding to this before, that this is going to be 2001 redux in the sense that the onus is going to be on the ratepayers.
It certainly was true that in 2001, customers ended up picking up about $8 billion in debt that PG&E had amassed through deregulation. And as someone pointed out earlier, this is a bit of a different situation. Whatever debts PG&E may amass, and as Commissioner Sandoval pointed out, they don't have them yet, those are of PG&E's own making. And we certainly hope that the bankruptcy court is not going to try to put that on us, the customers.
Well, what does the role of consumer advocates like turn in this whole process? I mean, has there been a role to play or any role at all?
Well, unfortunately, that's one of the big reasons why we think PG&E prefers bankruptcy court, because there is no role for customers. Not that we're not going to try to get into that court ourselves, and we tried it last time, but there's the only role for customers is to pay the bills, unfortunately.
Can I get a response from you, Commissioner, on that, Commissioner Sandoval?
So part of the question is, it's correct that we are concerned about who does bankruptcy court allow to have a voice? And so you see that both in some of PG&E's initial filings. They have listed their 50 largest creditors, who are predominantly some of the largest banks in America, and then companies like Turner Construction. But potential fire victims are not listed at all. And to be able to participate, to have a vote, or in a voice, really, and there is actually voting that goes on in bankruptcy court, there's going to be convened soon a creditors committee. So the creditors committee, as its name indicates, is composed of creditors. And ratepayers are not creditors. And so you have to argue that you are a party in interest and thus deserve a seat at the table. In the 2001 bankruptcy, the CPUC actually filed as a creditor because of money that PG&E owed to the CPUC. So they may be able to come in as a creditor, which will give them more of a traditional seat at the table. Otherwise, they would have to fight for a seat at the table as a party in interest. And that's also something that I know a lot of the groups that are interested in renewable energy, in reliability, in safety, in some of the other things that the bankruptcy court does not have jurisdiction over, can argue that they should be a party in interest to be able to discuss some of those issues, including preemption.
There are a lot of players in this, and a lot of those are not necessarily known to the public. I mean, I'm talking about gas suppliers and several solar power outfits, also talking, of course, about the banks. But in addition to that, California's credit rating is involved in this to a great degree. Lisa, you want to comment?
That's an interesting question. I don't know a lot about that. What I was going to jump off the commissioner is just this idea of these wildfire victims. And one thing that we've been having conversations with bankruptcy lawyers to try to get our arms around this. And one told me that she expects to see essentially the court will say, if you have a claim against PG&E, you need to refile it in this proceeding. And so everyone who has filed suit, and maybe people who have been thinking about it but haven't pulled the trigger yet, will actually come into this bankruptcy court and file that claim again. I think one of the big questions is whether the judge will treat those claims as one big case or as individual cases. The folks we talked to after the Tubbs findings seem to think that it will be harder because of the differences between all these fires and how many there have been, and the fact that Cal Fire has come up with different explanations for what started a lot of those, that it may not be so easy as to just say all wildfire victims are part of, you know, one sort of claim. And that's going to be complicated. And as we've said, we're still waiting to see what state investigators say about the Camp Fire. And there's previous fires. I mean, we've been talking a lot about 2017 and 2018, but we just saw last week that, or yesterday really, that PG&E stopped paying out claims that it had previously settled for 2015 fire in Butte County. So, you know, I think that that's the hard thing, is that for people like that, especially who had already sort of made this settlement, this agreement with PG&E, and we're probably counting on it to rebuild or relocate, even that is on hold. And so I think that's one thing about bankruptcy proceedings that's really interesting is, like, essentially what this does is put a stop payment on any debt accrued prior to today. And so vendors, for example, will have to go into this court and say, hey, we did this work for PG&E before January 29th, but they have to ask the court to approve paying them. Actually, in some ways, it'd be better to be doing work for them now, because with this dip financing we've talked about, they'll be able to pay those bills without, the same level of kind of oversight from the court in terms of approving every dollar that goes out.
Well, let me just go back to Mindy of TURN, and TURN is the Utility Reform Network, by the way, and they are a consumer group. Mindy Spett, your concern is that the shareholders are going to get the lion's share of this, I presume.
Well, creditors, certainly creditors come first in a bankruptcy court. And once again, I mean, what if you look at what's happening here, it's customers who are at risk of paying these costs. Now, we know it's a longstanding principle of utility law that customers should not be paying for a utility's liabilities and a utility's negligence. And moreover, in a bankruptcy court, none of that is going to be taken into consideration. So we're looking to the criminal court hearing tomorrow as a place where customers' interests may be in the forefront, because the judge in the criminal probation case has said, PG&E, either prove to me your lines are safe or shut them down. So in that forum, safety and customers' interests look to be at the forefront, whereas in the bankruptcy forum, we really come last.
Yeah, Catherine Sandoval.
Right. So one thing I wanted to emphasize is that the role of the PUC in the arguments about bankruptcy will also be to say, we have exclusive jurisdiction over safety and reliability, as well as enforcement of California's environmental laws as relevant to PG&E. And bankruptcy court, you don't have jurisdiction to displace us. Now, we've already seen that argument come from FERC, the Federal Energy Regulator, and under federal law, the Federal Power Act gives FERC jurisdiction over reliability and also rates, but not over safety. It is only the PUC that has jurisdiction over safety. So what we can expect to see is the state as well as federal regulators saying, wait a minute, you can't do certain things because it will actually impinge upon reliability. An example of that becomes if they're trying to say reject the contracts that are used to provide power or even write them down tremendously. At some point, you can actually create a power problem and a reliability problem by cutting off their financing. And so that's what we will look to the state to insist on its role, and that the bankruptcy court needs to respect the state's role in protecting reliability and safety.
Catherine Sandoval, again, is associate professor of law at Santa Clara University, former CPUC commissioner. And of course, the big questions come up. Should the utility be broken up? How much state control? The questions we've been taking on through the years here, and you may want to weigh in here. Indeed, we will hear from you. Let's say goodbye to Mindy Spett. Good to have you with us, Mindy. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks so much, Michael.
Mindy Spett, communications chief, return. Three studio guests remain, and your calls when we return. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about the bankruptcy of PG&E, and the effects are looming large on that, and really trying to straighten it all out with our guests. We have in studio Lisa Pickoff-White, who's data reporter and senior producer for KQED, and Marisa Lagos, reporter for KQED's California Politics and Government Desk and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown podcast. We had Mindy Spett on earlier, communications chief with TURN, the Utility Reform Network. And also here with us in studio is Professor Catherine Sandoval, associate professor of law at Santa Clara University and also a former CPUC commissioner. I want to go right to your calls. One quick tweet here, Catherine Sandoval, that just came through. Please discuss what happens if there's another huge fire caused by their lines.
Well, you know, first of all, the PUC should be taking steps to consider what can we do to prevent that from happening. So proposals are coming in pursuant to the bill that was passed last year, SB 901, that requires the utilities to say, here's what we need to do to prevent this, right? By looking at things like switching out uninsulated wires for insulated wires so that if a tree branch or vegetation falls on the wires, that it doesn't in fact cause a fire. So I think more needs to happen to step things up. And then also SB 901 that the legislature passed gave the PUC authority to issue certain bonds for fires ignited in 2017 or for fires ignited starting after January 1, 2019.
I just want to hook on with that with one other important fact. PG&E did say in its statement, we're going to do all we can in terms of fire prevention. Whatever
yes.
that means.
And they have a duty to continue to do so under federal and state law. State law requires that PG&E and all the other utilities offer safe, reliable service at just and reasonable rates, and also act consistently with California's environmental laws. And this bankruptcy does nothing to discharge them from that duty.
But I think, Michael, the problem here is that they haven't done that in the past. I mean, or allegedly in some of these
cases. We're thinking the same way here.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things we're seeing, Mindy mentioned this, is that there is this probation case. And just to back up, they're on probation because PG&E was was judged by a court to be a felon in relation to that 2010 gas line explosion down in San Bruno that killed eight people. As part of that probation, they're not supposed to break the law. And the judge basically said he wanted to order a really huge sort of sweeping safety review of their entire system. PG&E and federal prosecutors, I think it's worth noting, came back and basically said that's prohibitively expensive. And so I think to the caller's point, we still have a system that is not that different than it was a year ago. I mean, certainly there is more money, I think, coming in, not just from PG&E and the existing safety work they do, but that the state under that bill that was passed has sort of stepped up some of its prevention programs. But I don't think it's, I mean, as a resident, I would not say that we are in a much safer situation than we were last November when the Camp Fire broke out, or in October 2017 when the North Bay fires.
I think that's a statement we can stand by for now, unfortunately. But let me get some callers on here. Stephen, we go to you first. Good morning.
Hi, good morning, Michael. My name is Stephen, and I live in Sausalito, and I was a county counsel for the county of Sonoma. Back during the first bankruptcy, and there were three counties and the city and county of San Francisco that appeared in the bankruptcy court seeking a seat at the table, as Professor Sandoval mentioned. That's sometimes difficult to do if you're not a creditor. We were granted a very limited status, and we collectively objected to the fundamentals that PG&E was at the time bankrupt. They had a severe cash flow problem, as we understood it. And we suspected that they may well be seeking bankruptcy in order to get out from under control of the CPUC. That was our fear at the time. And to the extent there are lessons learned from that previous bankruptcy, I would urge anyone interested in elements of public interest related to this very major utility that they be very careful to make sure that whatever devolves from this bankruptcy not eliminate the public checks that exist. As limited as they may be, they're a lot better than if they were fully deregulated, in my view.
Yeah, Stephen, I appreciate hearing your view, and Professor Sandoval nodding her head here as you speak.
Well, that's good.
I mean, none of this should actually displace state regulation or state duty. And I also agree that PG&E has not lived up to their state duty, which is part of why the state has fined them on several occasions, and why when I served as a CPUC commissioner, I voted to impose the largest fine in utility history ever in the world on PG&E for some of their failures.
And let me thank Stephen for the call. I want to go to more calls here, and let me go next to a caller in San Francisco. Colin, you're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. Very briefly stated, what's going to happen to the PG&E employee pensions? PG&E was one of the last companies, at least for their older employees, to offer defined benefit retirement plans. Do those then become the transferred to the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation?
An important question. I thank you for it, Marisa. You can help us here.
So my understanding is that retirees and PG&E employees should not be that worried about it, that that pension is fully funded. It is sort of on separate books than what we're talking about. And as we've mentioned before, one of the things they're, you know, asking for this DIP financing for is to keep paying existing wages and benefits out of that. And that includes a lot of money, I think even more than wages, for benefit packages and other compensation. So I think employees should feel okay about that. I think the bigger question is the existing labor agreement between PG&E workers. Does the bankruptcy judge wade into that at all? We've seen that in other places. It doesn't seem like that's the big area that PG&E is asking the bankruptcy court to sort of cut. I think it's more based on their other debts and creditors and bondholders and such. But, you know, I think that there's I've already seen statements this morning from IBEW, which represents most of those workers, and they're not thrilled with this, which is interesting because they've generally been pretty in lockstep with the company on a lot of the sort of political fights that we've seen play out over this question over the last year or so.
Let me go to some. I'm sorry, Lisa. You want to
I was just going to say, note as well that that those pensions and those cuts did not occur during the 2001 bankruptcy.
I want to go to some questions here, and let me go back to you, Catherine Sandoval. Robert wants to know, can a judge reject the utility's application for bankruptcy, stating they don't meet the proper criteria? Is this even possible in here?
You know, that really may become one of the issues is ultimately in for each step, even for the approval of the debtor in possession financing. One of the reasons why that financing is attractive for a debtor is because it often is offered at lower interest rates because the judge needs to give it priority over other secured creditors. And that's not automatic, right? So we're going to see if there's protests from other existing secured creditors about that, then the judge will have to make a judgment. PG&E is going to have to come forward with more details about actually its debt and why the bankruptcy court should give it relief. And as we go forward, there will be more and more steps where you look at what exactly is their proposal? They have made no proposals so far about reorganization, about how they would treat things like pension plans, like existing contracts, let alone wildfire victims.
And I was just going to ask about the victims here. I mean, there are a lot of lawsuits here. Where are they going to go now, Lisa? Any thoughts?
Well, there's a couple of things that could happen to those lawsuits. I've talked to several attorneys, and, you know, they could all be grouped together. They could be put into multiple groups, which is more of what I've heard. In order for the lawsuits to be put together, they'd have to be about some kind of similar claim, whether a fire is that or is it vegetation management? What is there to bring the victims together? But what we do know is that, as Commissioner Sandoval pointed out, there's a list. There's an hierarchy of who gets paid first. And first, there's those DIP financers. Then there's the creditors. And at the very, very bottom are these fire victims and also insurance companies to be paid out. And that's very difficult for victims because a lot of those people are really relying on receiving that money in order to rebuild.
As somebody put it, there's going to be less money and it's going to take longer. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
That's kind of the pith of it, unfortunately. And Aaron wants to know, how will the bankruptcy affect everyone who has solar panels tied into the PG&E grid in the near term and long term?
Anybody? I'm not sure, actually.
So I think that it should not have an effect in the short term. Again, there are PUC rules about interconnection, also about the connection of power so that you have solar power and you'll be able to export. In fact, part of what PG&E asked for today in its filing was to be able to continue to operate what we call public purpose programs, which would include things like energy efficiency, various assistance programs, some of the environmental programs that essentially are what we call a pass-through, where ratepayers fund it. And PG&E isn't supposed to use it as a revenue source. They're just carrying out this program. So there shouldn't be any effects, certainly in the short term. But again, we'll see what they actually propose and if they would propose any changes that are fundamental that would change either jurisdiction or the program. And then the question also becomes the judge in bankruptcy doesn't have the power to order the PUC to do anything. So there's going to be, again, lots of rubs about where is the jurisdiction.
Here's a caveat from a listener named Joe who says, watch them closely. Bankruptcy protection is a ploy to hide all the money they can while reorganizing. And John says, why isn't there more discussion about breaking up PG&E? Well, we've talked about that a lot on this program, but he goes on to say it's been failing for years, putting profit above public safety and its customers. It gets away with it because of its de facto monopoly status. It's time to have a public utility take PG&E's place. Also say something with you, Catherine, since you served on CPUC, about how much lobbying plays into what has gone on with PG&E through the years and what's going on now, for that matter, in terms of the effect on the legislators in Sacramento.
Well, you know, legislative lobbying is a different matter. And actually, I see this bankruptcy filing, they may as well have taken a match to a draft bill and lit it on fire in the rotunda. You know, it's not going to gather goodwill when they're saying that they want goodwill in the legislature. But what I'd like to address is just the issue of restructuring. So the PUC, after I left, opened a proceeding to look at whether or not PG&E should be restructured and how. And one thing I'd like to emphasize is it in any analysis about restructuring, I think we also have to look at what is the contemporary problem. The contemporary problem that we're dealing with now, as opposed to the Enron-driven market manipulation problem in 2001, is that the maintenance and design of the infrastructure is not well suited for this climate with drought, where we see this drought and all these big, big dangers related to dry trees and vegetation. We're going to have to take a look at how do we change the design and maintenance of the lines to make sure that people are safe, regardless of who owns it. And even if that's a public entity, you know, you don't want to get into a situation that has sadly happened even with some public entities, where public entities don't update some of their lines or don't update, for example, water pipes. And then that's how LADWP flooded Poly Pavilion with a 100-plus-year-old water pipe, because they didn't update it because they didn't want to raise rates.
Forgive me, I just want to add here, there's been a lot of talk for quite some time about putting wires underground, but then the cost seems so prohibitive that it's excluded as even an idea. But think about these costs now that have occurred with the wildfires. I mean, it has to be weighed in the balance.
Absolutely. And in some places, undergrounding might be an appropriate solution. But again, with climate change, we're looking at sea level rise, we're looking at more flooding, and undergrounding and flooding do not go well together.
I do think, though, that there's a question about the incentive structure that the CPUC has provided for a utility like PG&E, and just the very sort of structure of an investor-owned utility, right, where you have this tension between the public good and what they're sort of promised and legally required to offer, which is affordable, safe, reliable power and gas, and the fact that ultimately you have shareholders who want to make more money. And I think that when, you know, Lisa and I have talked to employees of PG&E, their criticisms really lie with the top, that they feel like there's been this sort of rolling you know, line of executives who come in, don't necessarily know a ton about the utility and are there to cut some cost and make more money for Wall Street. And then they get out, you know, usually with a couple million dollars. And then, you know, the other thing I just want to mention is that there have been very serious questions that were raised by Sam Bruno about the CPUC and its independence and ability to regulate PG&E and other utilities. I think some of those, I think even some of the harshest critics do feel like there's been some progress made in recent years. But I think that's a big question for our current governor.
Well, just think of where they started.
Yeah. Right. And you've seen, you know, we did see Gavin Newsom, just to point, the one open seat that he had, he appointed a woman who served on the board for 20 years of the Sacramento Public Utility District, SMUD. And so I think that she's going to bring an interesting perspective. I think there's also questions about whether, you know, he could exercise his authority to name somebody else as president, and whether Michael Picker would stick around if he did that. So I do think that there's going to be things outside of these bankruptcy proceedings to watch around the politics of this. And we do know that last year alone, you know, PG&E, I think, doubled or tripled its lobbying as it was trying to get the legislature to pass some liability laws that they think, that they say may have prevented them from filing this bankruptcy.
And here's more of our callers. We go to you, Dara. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks. I just wanted to make a slightly different point, and it pertains to just the whole process of utilities, the way they get approval for the funding and the expenditures that they have through the general rate cases. I've worked in the industry in California and other states for several years, so I'm pretty familiar with it. But I think one thing would just that I'm not hearing in all these conversations, unfortunately, is there's obviously a lot of attacks on PG&E, the big bad utility, and they do deserve certainly some of it, a good deal of it, actually, especially in San Bruno and other cases. But with respect to the safety and the process that they go through for these lines, you know, there's a whole process in place where they request funding, and you have the consumer advocacy groups such as TURN and others who perform a very important role. But they do come in, and generally there's almost like a knee-jerk reaction to oppose anything that the utilities ask for. Then the PUC has to approve that funding. And in the past, because of pressures on keeping rates down, this is a much more complicated picture than just saying, well, the utility wants to make profits, so they cut back on what they did to keep the safety operations up. They have to face, you know, regulators and interveners and others who come in and cut funding or object to certain portions of it. So it's not just the utility by itself that decides, okay, we're going to, you know, stiff the ratepayers and cut back so that we can make more profit. And I think the role of these other parties really needs to be looked at, and some blame, frankly, needs to be also shared and acknowledged by them, because they had a role in it. I know they're all fleeing from this process now, but they're partially responsible, and they should own up to it as
Dara,
well.
Dara, thank you for that call, trying to really spread the culpability, Professor.
So one of the things that PUC started when I served as a commissioner is what we call risk-based decision-making, where there's actually a separate proceeding where the utility is supposed to identify, here are some primary risks that we see, and then there's an analysis of those risks. And then when they apply for what we call the general rate case, where this is the bill that you and I will pay, that the idea is that the proposed spending needs to be aligned to the risk. And so out of that, certain things have come out, such as the need to replace utility power poles. There are millions of utility poles out there. Utility pole failures have caused fires. That was the cause CAL FIRE found of the Lake Fire, the fire in Lake County. So there is some analysis of that. The SB 901 process, which is directed specifically at wildfires, will also help to say, okay, taking another look at risks, you know, what should we be doing for things like swapping out the uninsulated lines with insulated lines, especially in high wildfire danger. So I think, again, there has been a process to try to adjust things to say, this is not about, and it is not prudent to do what's called running to failure. Running to failure is dangerous, right? And this is not about doing the cheapest thing. It's about doing the right thing. So there needs to be a continued look at the regulatory process, but some of that was started with the risk-based decision-making, which SB 901 respects and does not displace.
And once again, Catherine Sandoval is Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University and a former CPUC commissioner. And our next caller is you, Dan. You're on the air. Good morning.
Thank you. Shout out to Professor Sandoval. Great to see you back. Go Broncos. My question is, we've heard different stakeholders. We have not heard about the California taxpayer. I know it costs, $15,000 a day to run a simple civil suit. How much is the taxpayer going to be on hold for any compromise? Because I can tell you, I don't know many people who want to pay for these Wall Street super bankers to get a good deal, and we have to pay for it. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for that question. Taxpayer liability.
Well, I think just the Mr. cost Lagos. Of bankruptcy is a huge question.
Yeah. Can I give you a huge question that's right in front of me here from a listener? How will the this listener says, I'm baffled by why PG&E stock would go up the day of their filing for bankruptcy. Can anyone explain how filing bankruptcy would benefit shareholders?
I can't. Maybe they're making a bet that ultimately the stock will keep rising. I mean, I think back to the original question. I mean, this is something I want to probe more, which is I've seen estimates that it could be hundreds of millions of dollars in lawyers' fees and consultants. They're bringing on bankruptcy experts. I mean, bankruptcy in itself is expensive. And I think absolutely as taxpayers and ratepayers, we're going to want to keep an eye on that.
Yeah, and I want to read also a comment from another listener. It says, even if a public PG&E fails to uphold safety as well At least executives won't be likely to be let go with tens of millions in severance. The executive profiteering is grotesque and unacceptable. A lot of listeners weighing in along those lines. Here's another question from a listener who says, what about exit packages for execs? Somebody want to comment on that, Lisa?
Well, SB 901 actually looked at that, and there were some changes. That's this law that we keep bringing up that was signed by former Governor Jerry Hill in 2018. And that actually limits what kind of executive packages can come out. I've seen a lot of talk that as PG&E declined to pay out Butte victims for this 2015 deadly fire, that an executive did, however, receive a $75,000 bonus. And that's something that we've long seen complaints about.
And their exiting CEO just got $2.5 million.
$2.5 million, exactly.
Just a few weeks before they're saying they can't afford to pay these Butte. So, I mean, I don't know that those are going to be held up in the bankruptcy court because they've already been paid out. But I think that, you know, to the former commissioner's point, there's not a lot of love for PG&E right now in Sacramento. And I think that this is something that even though they don't have control over the bankruptcy proceedings, lawmakers and the new governor will be watching really carefully.
Quick question, because I have the idea they're going to sell their headquarters here in San Francisco. It's about $1 billion.
It's certainly one of the assets that they could look at selling. But I think a really important point in all of this to come back to is that the CPUC is really the arm of the state in all of this. But what legislators could do is direct the CPUC to change how rate making works. And that's something that they did do with SB 901. And I talked to State Senator Jerry Hill this morning, who says that he's keeping a really close eye on the CPUC.
And I have to remind listeners that this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support this radio station, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And let me go to more of your calls here. Let me go next to a caller in San Jose. Gabe, you're on the air. Gabe, good morning.
Yes, I had a question if there would be a possibility of coming up with a private-public partnership where PG&E is broken up, the public transmissions and gas, pipelines are run by a public utility, and then the energy generation and gas supply itself are private entities. And I'll take my your comments off the air.
All right. Thank you, Catherine Sandoval.
So I think that this is one of the things we're waiting to see is proposals. And under bankruptcy law, the debtor, PG&E, has the first opportunity for about 4 months to file a proposal. They can ask for an extension on that. So then once they file a proposal, then others will react. And so I think that there's going to be a lot of questions about really what is the appropriate way to look at things? Certainly, they could do things such as apply to sell their building. They could still do that at the PUC. Their building is a regulatory asset that you and I pay for as part of our bills. And so they will be looking at things, I would think, such as selling their gas division and separating that out from the electric division, selling their building. But as you say, the question is, we need to look at other models. For example, like in Australia, they have full retail competition, full competition on the generation end, but the part that's regulated is the utility poles and the wires, the infrastructure, which is exactly what has caused the wildfire risk, both in Australia and in California, is still regulated. So that's an example of a model that could be looked at.
I'm just looking at some numbers here, $51.7 billion in debt, $71.4 billion in assets. Important thing to bear in mind. Question from a listener, Kevin, who tweets, I recently purchased a plug-in hybrid. PG&E offers an $800 incentive. Is the incentive at risk with bankruptcy?
It should not be. They, again, applied today to say, give us exceptions for these various public purpose programs that the CPUC has already approved. And they have been collecting money for that purpose. And the PUC could actually do more things, both with its existing and future rate making, to do what we call tying their hands. We give you this money only for this purpose. And if you underspend, you need to give it back. So that's something that I had actually advocated for a variety of utilities, and once in a while we did impose on some utilities, and that the PUC could be looking at doing more regularly.
And we'll bring in another caller, and that's you, Matt. Thank you for waiting. Join us.
Thanks so much. This is Matt with the No PG&E Bailout Coalition group that disrupted the PUC meeting yesterday. I just wanted to check in to see with the panelists here today, what's it going to take to have a serious conversation about a public takeover of the utility.
It's a big question, and it's one that's looming in many people's minds. Thank you for it. Who wants to step up to the plate here, so to speak, Marisa?
I mean, what's it going to take? I mean, I think we're starting to have that. I don't know. I think, I mean, certainly if that's something you support, I would say you should be contacting your state lawmaker and pushing Sacramento, because that's where the conversation would take place. I think our new governor would be another person that you would want to put that pressure if you think that's right. You know, I think that there's sort of a wide range of options beyond just keeping PG&E as it has been for the last 150 years. Could be making it a truly public utility. It could be making it more of a co-op or a B Corp or something that is not so investor driven. But I think that there's also some potential pitfalls to a lot of that. If we as ratepayers have spent a bunch of money to shore up PG&E infrastructure and they're going to then, you know, sell it to us, how does that work out if we've already invested money in that? I mean, they do have these shareholders, right, who would be owed something. So I think there's a lot of complicated questions around that. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have the conversation, but I will say that, you know, someone like Senator Jerry Hill, who's really dogged PG&E since San Bruno, I think is being looked at in a new light this year. I think he was sort of on the fringes for a long time, and I'm not sure that's the case anymore. As I said, there's a lot of anger at this utility, and I think a strong feeling that even though other state utilities face similar challenges, that they have done a better job of stepping up and trying to at least, you know, attempt to handle them.
Well, we'll leave it there, and we'll see how this all unfolds. Thank you all for your expertise, and so good to have you with us this hour. And again, we will continue to follow this story as it unfurls, as I said before. I want to thank Lisa Pickoff-White and Marisa Lagos from our news department. And thank Catherine Sandoval, joining us this hour, former CPUC commissioner and associate professor of law at Santa Clara University. We also spoke with Mindy Spad of Tern. And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated in the evening, 10 to 11, and another hour of Forum up ahead. So stay tuned for that. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.